I've said to you many times, I think Kodai Senga is the best pitcher that the Mets have, better than Freddy Peralta. It's just what's going on between the ears has held him back. What I've read, though, so far, because we still haven't seen him, he's supposed to pitch on Saturday, is that he's seeing himself as a power pitcher, which is what he is. That's what he was when he started, 97, 98, and then the devastating forkball. Last year, rinky-dink, 93, 92, tinkering. Just wasn't him. It didn't feel like him. So far, if you can love reports and you can love hoping, I love the hoping, but I'm kind of like everybody else. I want to see it, and then I'll believe it.
Yeah, I don't trust it, but the fact that Mendy says it's the best that he's seen him, that at least is encouraging, plus maybe a shift in attitude after the trade rumors early on. He had that, too. He can make a difference in that rotation. And how about Christian Scott, Todd? What do you think about Christian Scott potentially being a—
I like Christian Scott. Before I go on to that, I got to see Senga live BP, and it was impressive. It was 97 coming right out of the gate, so he's got something to prove. But Christian Scott is a guy that I also watched throw down there, and it's kind of like— you forget about this guy. You're like, wait a minute. Oh, yeah, this guy was really good before he got hurt. And he looks really strong again. Live arm. Looks like he's throwing without any pain. He looks like he's having fun out there. He's got the fastballs. That's got some life on it. And then the slider sweeper, which was always a good pitch for him. You wonder how that comes back after a surgery like he had and after all that time off. It looks sharp. Those are sharp, tight little ones right there. And I saw him throw some bigger sweepers when he was throwing in BP as well. So, look, I think he's a guy that nobody really thought about except for as a depth piece, but I think he's opening some eyes again.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, March the 8th, 2026. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com, and come join us at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. Chat for free, premium content, updates on the show. You want to know what's going on in the world of the Talking Mets podcast? Go to thetalkingmetspodcast.com. It'll let you know exactly what the latest is, where to find me. And I'd like to thank the good folks from the Believe Network for supporting this show. Welcome to another edition of the Talking Mets podcast. We're about 3 weeks away from opening day, the WBC in full force. Spring training hasn't hit the dog days, but we're close. And quite honestly, today, we got a couple of things to go through. Positional battles crystallizing. It's getting down to the nitty-gritty. I'll let you know what my thoughts are and where this thing is going. Juan Soto and the Mets offense. How much better is the Mets offense with all the question marks? Looking at last year's team, a team that was feast or famine at times, a team that was streaky offensively, how much better can the Mets offense be? I'll look at that. We'll get back to the mailbag and all the things that we do here on March 8th as we start to head into the meat and potatoes of the spring and opening day, you know, daylight savings time today. We get an extra hour of daylight. You could feel the baseball right there. You could feel the spring there. You could feel the summer there, which is funny because 2 weeks ago we had 30 inches of snow here in New York. So it's amazing how things turn on a dime. And then the big news this week, our good friend contributor David Mills will have his top pitching prospect, the Talking Mets top pitching prospects. Everybody has a prospect list. It's fun. I think it's fun to see everybody's perspective. Dave, with his background in youth sports and having the ability to kind of navigate through the league and meet people and talk to those in player development, I think has a really, really good sense of exactly what's going on in the Mets system. He's been on some guys, and we'll have that piece later this week, so look out for that. And then he and I will probably, next week, we'll probably be able to get on the show and chat a little bit about that and look at the Mets pitching, which will be a theme here today. And let's kick off first with the positional battles. Before I get to Manaea and Senga and kind of, you know, some of the other things going on. And I'll start with this before we get into to anything. I mean, if you don't think baseball is a cruel game, I mean, look at the story of Robert Stock pitching well for Team Israel, coming into camp, 36 years old, spent the winter basically on Twitter talking about pitching, using some kind of app he developed with AI to, you know, break down pitcher spin and stuff. And looks like he's trying to either, I mean, clearly still playing, trying to improve himself in the late stages, the last stages of his career, but also maybe work his way to eventually working in baseball in some capacity, whatever that may be. But looking at someone at that age who's been through a lot, former second-round pick, was looking really good this spring. And look, when I was looking at the bullpen in those final two spots, which we'll get to in a couple of minutes, I said, hey, I know Robert Stock is a non-roster invitee. I know he's 36. Perfect guy at that point in his career. Nothing to lose, to try different things. And you never know. Sometimes guys late in careers, even if it's a year or two, pop up and have these crazy seasons. And you're wondering, can Robert Stock be like the story of 2026? And for a hot minute he was, and that's how this thing goes. That's why it's a marathon, it's a journey, because the bad news came out last night that he has a need for TOS surgery. I know that now it's like there's the good TOS and the bad TOS, because some pitchers have come back, and you know, Zach Wheeler's got the good TOS, he's got the bad TOS. I know it has to do with the pressure on the nerve. TOS, any kind of, let me tell you this, and any pitcher will tell you this, shoulder injuries are bad. There's no good shoulder injury. There's no bad shoulder injury. There's levels of bad, but they're all bad. And typically you don't come back the same. Now, there are exceptions throughout the history of the game, but just know it's not an elbow. All arm injuries are bad for pitchers. It's not an elbow. Shoulders are far more complicated and they're harder to heal and they're harder to bounce back from, and they're career enders. So hopefully that's not the case for Robert Stock. I wouldn't bet on it to see him again, but it was a nice story, and I'm sure from a standpoint of analytics and on X, as he recovers, I'm sure we'll hear more about it, and we'll probably learn a little bit. So, you know, baseball is a cruel game. It knocks out one pitcher's name that I still had there on the board, but let's just get to where the Mets are at, and I don't think the positional battles, as things are starting to work their way out, are really there. There's not much left. Look, it comes down to, I think, simply a couple of things. One, is Lindor going to be on the opening day roster? Is he going to be healthy enough? And we don't really know that right now. And all signs, and even when you hear Carlos Mendoza talk, is that he will be. So for the purposes of this exercise, we'll just say, okay, Lindor is going to be on the roster. Mike Talkman continues to show a live bat, and I think it's very likely that he gets added to the roster and he makes the team. Every time you watch him play, he's doing something. The bat looks live. He's doing something out there that makes you see a player that wants to be on the roster. And look, when you start to look at him at this, you know, what are you getting out of Mike Talkman? The last few years in Chicago, whether it be with the Cubs or last year on the South Side with the White Sox, plays about 100 games, gets about 350 to 400 at-bats, a 740 OPS, about 10 home runs, good against both sides. I think the question is what you saw in 2019 with the Yankees when he admirably subbed in, hit 13 home runs, had an OPS in the high 800s, on-base percentage of almost 370, was a big part throughout the summer when they had some injuries of that Yankees ball club. Is that a player that's still in him in some kind of part-time work? Later, again, we talked about Robert Stock. Later in his career, has he been through a lot? Went to Korea for a year, has come back and been a better player since he went to Korea. So is something triggered in him? And then the real part of this is, yeah, I know Carson Benj has had a nice spring and has gotten a lot of hype, but would it behoove him to go to AAA for 6 to 8 weeks, spend the spring in Syracuse, work out whatever kinks are out there? Don't rush him. Yes, I know what you're thinking. You're saying that. You're talking like an executive. You're talking like a front office type. You don't want to be able to lose the year of control, especially with all the uncertainty of the CBA. But if Talkman, a veteran, is giving you kind of what, let's face it, we don't know what Benj is going to be. But right now, if Benj came up and gave you 400 at-bats, 750 OPS, 10 home runs to 12 home runs, 50 to 70 RBIs, and had that kind of impact and showed a promise for the future, you'd be okay with that. You would say, all right, I'll sign that. Not where you want him to be. You want him to be better. Look, there's all sorts of ranges that Benj has been compared to, from Kyle Tucker at the high end to Nick Markakis, you know, and even Steve Finley. You know, I've heard all different types of comps. And, you know, whatever he turns out to be, it is him. And Markakis is a really solid player. But right now, the question is, if you have Talkman, and Talkman, at least in the intro, when Benj is finding his way, is giving you enough here, then why not? I mean, look, even Juan Soto, when he was called up by the Nats in, I think it was 2018, he started the year in the minors. Not long, but he started the year in the minors. It does happen. I know that a lot of that has to do with service time manipulation, but it does happen. So the question is Benj going to make it? We really don't know. The Mets have been nothing but complimentary about him. There's a part of me that thinks he's not, and I think that Talkman plays a lot into that. I think MJ Melendez is an all or bust guy, and I think he's depth. I think he's going down to the minors. I think the same thing with Jared Young. You got Morabito down there that's going to, you know, work on his game. And let's see, after his Arizona Fall League breakout, is this guy a viable? Is he 4A? Is he a viable backup outfielder? Can he be more in the big leagues? But, I mean, the real question is, at 34, is Talkman going to be able to? And look, maybe he keeps Benj down there longer than you think if he has a big year. And in a lot of ways, I mean, remember, Benj struggled for the most part at AAA at the end of 25. And it's not going to sit well with the fans if he gets sent back down. And I did say he needed to have a spring like Pete Alonso and rip the position away. Also, remember, Pete Alonso had the benefit of having not much competition at first base when he was grabbing that position in 2019. Basically, he obliterated Dom Smith, which, looking back, wasn't that hard to do because Dom Smith wasn't really a good prospect. He was an overrated prospect. He's been an overrated player his entire career. So, a little bit different. Talkman, hungry veteran, a guy that's, you know, playing and singing for his supper year to year now at age 34, would like probably another 3 or 4 years, and at the end of his, you know, late prime, past his prime, to get himself solidified as a big leaguer so he doesn't have to come to camp every year and sing for his supper over there. So Robert Jr. getting rave reviews. You keep hearing good things. We, you know, we wrote about him over at Extra Innings, and we talked about him, and we'll get a little bit more into that when we talk about the offense and Soto later at this point. And then the other question would be, is if Benj doesn't make the roster and Lindor does, what do you get? You get Jackson Clough, you get Brujan, do you get that utility infielder? Because right now, I mean, Brett Beatty's not going to play short. Beatty's going to be the guy that's going to play third. He's going to play first. It looks like he's even going to play corner outfield. He's essentially taking over for McNeil in a lot of ways right now, and what have you. But at that point, if Benj doesn't make it, then, you know, I think both of those guys are a very real possibility. Mets have always been a little light on backup shortstop. Last year, they had Luis Angel Acuna. How they value the glove, a Clough that has a glove, a really good glove, versus Brujan, who has some big league experience. He was already on the roster. I have a feeling Brujan gets the call because he's already on the roster. So we'll see. So that's where it's at. I think a lot will depend on always health. But more importantly, you know, Mauricio will definitely be sent down to play every day. More importantly, I think it'll be about whether or not Carson Benj makes the roster. Because if Carson Benj makes the roster and Lindor makes the roster and you want to keep Talkman, then there's not, you know, there's not going to be room for another middle infielder. And I just wonder, the only other reason not to carry a versatile middle infielder type like a Brujan or a Clough is that, okay, you have Bo Bichette, who in a pinch could play short. Not ideal when you want him, not well, but he could play short. Jorge Polanco could play second, could play short. You have other options at first in Vientos and Beatty if you need to go that route and put Polanco in the middle infield. But knowing how important defense is, and we've always talked about, and there's always been questions, you know, how important could it be for David Stearns if he brought in Polanco and Bichette, who have not played their respective positions in the corners? Well, that's because it's the corners. When you start messing around with the middle infield, you want to be a little bit more careful with that. So I think that's where the positional battles go. Now, as far as the real battle here, it's certainly not in the rotation. We got to see Senga and Minaya. I'll get to them in a minute because I have some concerns. You know, we've been talking about it over and over and over again, the core five, Williams, Weaver, Rayleigh, Myers, and Garcia. And then it was a matter of, do they take another lefty until Minter is healthy and Brian Hudson? Do they, because Brazenbaum has options, do they send him down and give a veteran like Kimbrell an opportunity, an Austin Warren, another veteran that's been okay, that I think at times has been a victim of numbers here, could probably be in a lot of bullpens across baseball. He's got good numbers. Seems to, whatever sample size or small sample size he pitches in, he puts up good numbers. Saved the Mets on a couple of the shuttle scenarios last year. But then the real guy that's broken into the party and giving you something to think about is a name that we talked about during the winter more as potentially an emerging homegrown bullpen arm. But here's Ryan Lambert throwing 99, getting swings and misses, lighting up the radar gun every time he comes in. And given, obviously, Carlos Mendoza and David Stern something to think about, possibly a future high-leverage homegrown bullpen arm, to the point where, and we don't know why, and the Mets haven't talked about it, and maybe it'll come out, Dylan Ross was sent down really without getting any game action. And before everybody gets crazy, because I did see, and when I get to the mailbag, I saw some information on this. Before people get crazy, the Mets are not just using games to evaluate. They're doing plenty of work. You don't know. There could be some health issues. There could be something they saw in the backfields. So don't get crazy when guys don't get game work. Now, Brian Hudson, the lefty, is in the same spot. I've put him in there, and I continue to put him in. He hasn't, from what I see, I don't think he's pitched. I'll have to check that again on the spring training stats. But, you know, he hasn't pitched at all. But I'm still keeping him in there because, you know, he's left-handed, and I think that was part of it. But could you see a scenario where do they come north with one lefty in the pen? With just Raley, it's possible. You got a guy like Brazenban, who, if I remember correctly, Brazenban has actually been pretty good in the past against lefties, but I have to check. It was actually maybe not. But I can look at that before the show is out a little bit. You know, we'll see how that all turns out. We'll see how that plays. But really, that is your positional battle. You got the veteran Kimbrell trying to get another shot out there. You've got the upstart kid in Lambert, wowing everybody, and then in between you have your Brazenbans and your Hudsons, who have been guys that have been good and bad and all sorts of in between throughout their big league career. So that's really where you're at with the positional battles. And you know, look, there's tons of interesting arms. Carrillo got sent down, Ross, you know, obviously there's going to be other names that are going to pop up throughout the year as the Mets farm system continues to start to percolate when it comes to the arms. Now, the real conversation goes back to the starting rotation. And when I say baseball is a cruel sport, I mean, think about this. Baseball is a cruel sport because you go from talking about arms and having too many arms and veterans that, you know, don't have options that you might lose at the end of spring training to, within a blink of an eye, you have Robert Stock out with TOS surgery, Brandon Waddell, who's looked good this spring and who actually has been a guy since they got him, when he's been on the shuttle, made starts, and come in and done some bulk work, has been pretty good. And I had him as one of the depth arms. When I say as a starter, probably more as a as an opener, bulk guy, somebody that could help you in those scenarios. But, you know, now you're already down two. When you start to look at the depth here, you still have Jonah Tong, who looks like he needs some work and is working. Jonathan Pintaro, who, you know, maybe more of a bullpen arm. Hageman, Justin Hageman, we saw him last year, again, similar to Waddell, a bulk guy. And then you got the two big names in Christian Scott and Jack Weininger. And Weininger was great yesterday against the Cardinals. Scott was great the other day. I think it was against Miami. You know, both were really flashing some elite stuff, daring you to dream, bringing up shades of 2015 when the Mets went into the season with Jonathan Neese and Dylan G in their rotation. And by the end of the year, those guys were, one guy, G, was out for the year, and then Neese was going in, becoming a situational lefty in the bullpen. But it's a little too soon, and I know with Scott coming back from Tommy John surgery, he's got a ways to go. He's probably going to be eased back into things and not be overused this year and have some sort of innings limitation. But you dare to dream now where you right now are going to go north with six starters, provided they all are healthy. You have Tong, who would be your seventh starter, provided that he could continue to develop and show that he could be trusted, even in a small sample size. You've got Scott and Weininger, who look to be next up on the list. And we haven't even gotten to other arms like Watson and Santucci and Zach Thornton and guys like that. And I'm probably missing somebody at this point. And we'll talk more about that, obviously, when we bring out our top pitching rankings within the week. But to me, the real question and the real storyline, and I'm going to call it here now on March 8th, the storyline, as we get into the getting to know you phase, as we get into April, where it's all about winning, man. It's all about the game, but it's also the story is developing, the roster is developing. And as you guys all know that listen to this show and watch the games, we're learning about the team, particularly that first month. And as you learn about the team, I think there are two veterans in the rotation that have a lot of question marks, showed some red flags during their outings in the spring. Again, early, even though it's 3 weeks before opening day, or three-ish weeks before opening day, they'll have plenty of time in the next 3 weeks. That's a lot of time for a pitcher to evolve into shape and to show that they go from question mark to, hey, they're ready. It can happen very quickly. It's always a question of, do you peak? And everybody, you know, Scott and Wendinger are way different spot in their careers than Manaea and Senga, who don't need to wow at these times, whereas those guys, they want to wow. They're young, and they want to get into the mix here. Those other two guys, the veterans, are maintaining themselves. But you can't help but question where you have Manaea in the high 80s. Look like, you know, 60% of his pitches were either a cutter or a four-seamer, so maybe he's working on that arm angle, working on stuff. He talked about that, the mechanics and everything. But, I mean, let's face it, he was already down in velocity on average last year. He had the bone chips. He actually had quite a high strikeout rate and a low walk rate, but he was very hittable. He seems to believe it has to do with his mechanics. He's working on that. But not something that lends itself to being optimistic after the first outing. Again, first outing, we'll see, but certainly a question mark. Senga, I watched him myself over the couple of innings that he pitched. Fastball up to 98, so the velocity is back. The couple of homers, one was... would have been a blast. I think it was Baez, one of the kids of the Cardinals. It went out, but the wind was actually knocking it down. The other one may have been win-aided, but there was tons of hard contact. So if you watch the game, there was tons of hard contact throughout the outing. I think that everybody is kind of downplaying that. Again, his first start, he's been working on the backfields. And I think that Senga, in a lot of ways, because last year at least, you felt it was... there was the hamstring injury, which at this point you'd have to think he's been healed from. So it wasn't his shoulder, it wasn't his arm, and he's got shoulder issues. Remember, he initially was out with a shoulder issue in 24 before he came back and then, you know, hurt his lower body. So with Senga, I think performance is a little bit more important, but a guy that's really about process, we're about ramping up, a very high-maintenance pitcher, let's call it like it is. And you know, even Ron Darling called it out a week ago. And as you go into the season, and I think the first 2 months leading into Memorial Day, and you have these six starters, I think how Manaea and Senga pitch is going to be a big part of the storyline, because if they don't pitch well, you have options. Let's assume that they're good options. Let's assume that Tong is good. Let's assume that Wendinger continues to impress. Let's assume that Scott stays healthy and starts to build himself up. I mean, if anything, Scott might be a more of a bullpen option. We talked about that being a bullpen option later in the year, similar to how they used Peralta and Burns and Woodruff at certain points, which Stearns did in Milwaukee before they established themselves in the rotation. But I could see a scenario where they work themselves into maybe the season a little bit. And I'm not saying they should leave it all out in April, but I don't think the fans will have the patience for a slow start for Senga. And I think the more that Manaea struggles, the question will be, was 2024 an outlier? Because remember, he came to the Mets on a reasonable deal because he had been inconsistent and struggling with San Diego, with San Francisco, up and down, up and down. You know, always a talented guy, but a guy that everybody thought after the OMG put it together. Also look at where the position the Mets are, how much better a year later. And the starting pitching is what undid them. Manaea and Senga were your one and two. Those are the guys that were you going to anchor your rotation with a questionable signing of Frankie Montas, who had some upside. But those were the guys you brought in. Now, you're looking at Manaea Senga being 5-6. You've got Peralta on a walk year, which sometimes, you know, is something that always you have to play into. Is this going to be the best year of his career? You've got McClain. You've got Clay Holmes going out there. I know it was against Great Britain, showing elite stuff. It looks like he moved himself around on the rubber a little bit to help him with his deception. I was reading some stuff over by that Rob Freeman. What is that? The pitching ninja, a great account over at X. So I was reading a little bit about that. So you have a lot of bullishness about the rotation at the top. A lot of bullishness. But when you look at the veterans like Senga and Manaea, and look, even Peterson, who could be wildly inconsistent, the other three, you wonder what you're going to get. And if any of those guys are a disaster, if Manaea and Senga, one or both, repeat what you saw in the second half of last year, then a couple of things are negative about it. It's bad outings, but you're also in a six-man rotation taking away, let's say, 3 to 5 starts from a Freddie Peralta, potentially from Clay Holmes, who I know that he was up and down last year. Maybe he got a little tired his first year transitioning to the rotation in the second half, but he's got great stuff. And look, I think he could be a really solid number three. I know there's been some debates about that, and I know that there's a lot more to go than just WBC outing against Great Britain, but look, I always felt, and some people have compared him to Logan Webb with the way he has that bowling ball type sinker. But we'll see. I mean, again, this is the time of the year where comps get crazy and maybe we can all, take a step back. But you have to feel good about that. And then the real question is throughout the spring, here in the early spring, the calls for Wininger, the calls for Scott, the calls probably for Tong, especially if he's pitching well, will get louder. And then the problem you have there is your starting depth that you thought you had goes away pretty quickly. Because you start to eat away. And look, you're going to eat into 9 or 10 of these guys. You got 6. You've got at least one kid in 7. I haven't counted a Carl Edwards, who might be a scrap heap a guy to put in there. Who knows if Waddell, how injured he is. I know his shoulder's hurting. Hagedman, all these guys. You're going to use these guys. You're going to use 10, 11, 12 guys between rain and doubleheaders and everything like that. But if Manaea and Senga are bad, well, what are you going to do with them? They're expensive. Senga's got a multi-year deal. Senga's got a couple of years left. Manaea's got a couple of years left. You've got these very expensive arms that, I mean, are not going to be helpful in the bullpen, are blocking potential starting options. You can't just, I'm sure you could put them on the IL. There might be a way to say, hey, look, we want you to work on some stuff. Go on the IL, go down to Port St. Lucie, work on it. I mean, they've done that. But at some point, they have to have an injury. You can't just phantom it. I mean, I know that that's a whole other conversation. So I think the first 6 to 8 weeks, I think Manaea and Senga and how good they are and what they produce. And I'm not expecting, even if Manaea is not what he was a couple of years ago, and I'm not expecting Senga to be 2023 Senga. I'm expecting him to go out and give competitive outings and maybe in some cases show flashes of top of the rotation form. But in more times than not, they go and get you into the 6th inning. Maybe an out or two in the 7th. They keep the opposition to 2 or 3 runs. I'm not saying it has to be a dominant clean-out, and it could be littered with base runners and some big pitches and maybe some hard contact. I mean, that might be part of it, but you want them to have competitive outings. And what you saw yesterday was players working on their stuff, but I'm not so sure it was a competitive. And again, caveat, first outing, not trying to pick on these guys. All I'm saying is these are thoughts that come to my head as I watch spring training now. And this is probably one of the more difficult spring trainings. Every time we have the WBC, it's difficult because you're not getting your players against the top competition on the other side because everybody's across the world now with the WBC. That'll only be for a couple of weeks. I mean, the last week they'll all be back. And hopefully the competition doesn't hurt anybody. I'm not saying in a freak way like Diaz a few years ago. I'm talking about a McClain throwing too hard or getting the juices going earlier than normal because you're in this, nationalistic competition, playing for the country across your chest and things like that. So that's where we're at. Early concerns? No, just some red flags. And I think that's why the theme of the show is pitching red flags, because you go from excess to not enough very quickly. You go from bullish on a rotation to bearish very quickly. And I think right now, you have reasons to be bullish on the Mets rotation, and I think you have reasons to be bearish on some of the Mets rotation. And I think that the 6 starters only works if all 6 guys are competent. I think if even one of them is very bad, and I'm not saying, 6 innings, 3 runs, that's competent, right? I'm talking lack of competitive outings, short outings, non-competitive where the team is out of the ball game off the jump. then you have to question if the six-man rotation is even worth it, because now you're giving about 20 to 25 starts to somebody who, for the most part, is forcing you to potentially punt many games, which is what the problem was in the second half. So early things. I think that probably you're going to put these in the bin of concerns that never happened, Mike, but we'll see. So, all right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, is the Mets offense better than last year? And more importantly, could we possibly be seeing or be in the midst of the best of Soto over the next 2 to 3 years? I'm not going to give you a data-driven reason. I'm going to give you a very anecdotal reason. But you may be entering the top 2 or 3 years of Soto's career where, not that he's going to be bad after, but this might be the best version of Soto you're ever going to get. I'll tell you about that and more right after this. All right, we're back. So we've been talking so much throughout the spring about, obviously, Benj and A.J. Ewing and the Mets pitching and the kids. And I mean, obviously, that's going to be a big part of it because you have so many veterans on this roster. And at this point, a Bichette, a Polanco, a Simeon, those are veterans that have the back of the baseball card. Two of them are learning new positions. Unless they're injured or they're not adjusting to New York or in steep decline, which maybe that's a question for Simeon, you know what you're going to get out of them. And there's some variability. I think the real big wild card, and we talked about it over at Extra Innings, and it's been talked about over and over and over again at various points since he was acquired in January, is Luis Robert Jr., who's a guy that five-war player a couple of years ago, gold glove, all-star, a guy that potentially might have been a 30-30 guy, righty bat power, really good defense. You know, when you have Taylor and he out there, you have a couple of really good outfielders. I mean, he may not be as good as Taylor. It depends on some of the metrics you look at. But Robert Jr.'s got, maybe not the same arm, but it looks like range-wise, some of the metrics are really kind to him versus Taylor. So you have a lot of interesting pieces to the Mets offense here going into 2026. But is it better? And that's the question. And obviously, with Pete Alonso no longer with them, with Brandon Nimmo no longer with them, with Jeff McNeil no longer with them. And I think the biggest out of the three, I think Nimmo's production is replaceable, especially as he gets into the latter part of his career, maybe declining a little bit from the elite, elite run creator that he was about 3-4 years ago. Alonso's the big question. And then it's, in general, is what could you expect out of your top 10 stars here in Lindor and Soto? And I'll start there. So Lindor, we know that there's some questions about the Hamann injury, middle infielder, getting into the later prime years. Can he still sustain what he is? You saw some declines on defense. Will he be able to hit right-handed? Those are all questions we'll get answers to. An elite athlete like Lindor, who puts the time in, I think is going to come up affirmative. I do think you're seeing the last couple of years of elite Lindor. I think as he hits age 35, we've done some metrics. Even a guy like Derek Jeter, as he hit the mid-30s, you're going to see some declines. Doesn't mean they're going to be bad players. They could even be all-stars. They're not going to be at the same level of elite. Look at guys like Cal Ripken. Even Alan Trammell, a Hall of Famer like Alan Trammell. Look at how they hit into their mid-30s. Now, Lindor is in a different sports medicine time, and he's a different physical player, so you may not want to compare, but that's something to take into consideration. So really, and we talked about this, and this was a theme earlier in the offseason when I did a show about these two guys, the next 2 or 3 years might be the best of this combo you're ever going to get. Now, that doesn't mean you want to put all your eggs in the basket and say win now or bust, but I think that you have a very good chance of doing something special with those two guys, because you really don't know. Look, you have Elian Pena down there. You have Benj. You have Ewing. But you just don't know offensively when the next star of the level of Lindor and Soto, remember that, of the level of Lindor and Soto, is going to come around. So when you get these kind of two guys together, it's something special. Now, before we get to why I think it might be Soto's, the next 2 or 3 years, his best years of his career, as he enters age 27. Let's just look at the Mets offense, really. And what's amazing about the Mets offense is they were undone last year by starting pitching. But I think they could have been even better earlier in the year if they had scored some runs. What gets glossed over or paved over of the 2025 Mets is August. They scored 177 runs in August. They scored almost 23 to 25% of their season run production in 1 month. They were incredible during the month of August. Yeah, they faced Seattle. There was a San Francisco staff in there. The Phillies were in there. So they faced some tough pitching teams. Milwaukee was in there during that stretch. But there was the Nats. There was the Braves, who were non-competitive with their pitching. There was a weekend when Miami came to town, and they played slow pitch softball against them, too. So they had some, and they had some big outings in that sample size. So keep that in mind. But they were, without August, a team that had a number of brownouts, which is what you wanted, and what they've really struggled from really for a while. Even when they had everything gelling in 2022 with that offense, they were prone to brownouts because of the bottom third of the lineup. There was some soft spots. There was catching. Eduardo Escobar kind of had a soft second half in 2022. You know, maybe Mark Canna, had some leveling out. Marte got injured, things like that. So you had periods where they've had downgrades at certain positions, and they've been a little short on offense, and that's caused some brownouts and things like that. So, you know, what can you expect this year? When you look at the baseline, and that's really what you could do, is the areas where the Mets struggled offensively that really, like, center field killed them. We talked about this week over at Extra Innings. Taylor, at one point during the summer, had an OPS under 400. He was like a pitcher, a bad hitting pitcher, mind you. Even with all the great defense, he had some negative net value there because the bat was so bad. You know, you had okay performance out of your DH spot, a 727 OPS. Your catching situation was mainly due to Alvarez's struggles and injuries. Wasn't always good. You had some power there, but it was an OPS under 700. And then even second base, and I think it's interesting that everybody's worried about Semien. Last year, your second baseman hit .237, slugged under .400, had 14 home runs, 52 RBIs. A lot of people forget a lot of McNeil's production happened playing around the diamond with a little bit of outfield in there. And then you had Beatty there for a little bit at second base. He struggled early with the bat. And then Acuna, a lot of Acuna action, which we know Acuna struggled with the bat. So when you look at center field in second, at the very least, with Robert Jr. giving you not 2023 Robert Jr., but let's say he gives you 710 OPS, 17 to 20 home runs, 20 stolen bases, above average, maybe not elite, but borderline gold glove defense. All of a sudden, you go from Taylor and Cedric Mullins, and Mullins was worse than Taylor because he didn't even bring the glove with you, to an upgrade. I think the numbers at second base from a year ago are very reasonable, and I know that Semien's coming off the Liz Frank injury, which, again, bad Liz Frank, good Liz Frank. I mean, these are not good injuries, and he's had some declines offensively. But even if he could give you what his projection system says he could give you, which is 700 to 710 OPS, 20 home runs, 80 RBIs, gold glove defense, that's a huge upgrade on offense and obviously helps you on the defensive side. I think the real question here is, can Soto have, and I look back to Carlos Beltran, and I know maybe this is not apples to apples, but it was something that I thought about as I was studying the Mets offense, looking at how comfortable Soto has been his second camp with the Mets. He's got his contract. He produced last year. I mean, for as much as people said he had a bad year, when you look at Soto's career, just going to OPS Plus at Baseball Reference, you look at his career, taking the COVID season away, 2024 with the Yankees and Judge, a 179 OPS Plus, 2021 in a rather naked Nats lineup. I know Schwarber was in that lineup, 175 OPS Plus, but I think Schwarber was traded later in the year. And then the next one up, 2025 with the Mets, 160 OPS Plus. Better than any of San Diego numbers. Obviously better than his early years with the Nats when he was, still very good. But that was when he was, one of those years he was behind Harper, and then he was behind Rendon and some of the veterans on the championship team. So it's not like Soto was chopped liver. He was not so great the first month and a half. Very great the rest. Now, he had Pete Alonso in that lineup, and the question is, will Bo Bichette protect Soto in a similar way? And I think the one thing that Bichette has that Alonso doesn't, and somebody in baseball had texted me this when they were watching him. about how he shortens up a lot with two strikes. I mean, Bichette is going to be more of a threat because if you're a pitcher and you walk around Soto and you have runners on base, you have a guy behind him that can make some contact that could shorten up. Pete never really did that. He tried at times. And I think he did a better job of it last year. I mean, I think the best version of Pete Alonso was last year. And it's not going to be easy to replace that in the short term. Forgetting about long-term deals and age and body and defense, throw it all away. Would Pete provide you 35, 120, that prodigious power? There's a fear behind that that you cannot calculate. And Bichette doesn't put that into you. He's not that fear, like of the guy that's just going to wreck a game. But to me, you got a guy that could hit, and he hit 370 in the second half of Toronto, that does have power, but can make contact. That's going to be as dangerous for pitchers behind Soto. Now, it's not Aaron Judge, and nobody's Aaron Judge. I mean, Pete was as close as you're going to get, and that's way, 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 way off from what Aaron Judge is. But it's good. And with his comfort level, looking at how Beltran had the big postseason in Houston, just like Soto had the big season with the Yankees, gets the big contract, struggles. Now, Soto didn't have injuries, but Beltran had the gruesome collision with Cameron in the outfield. 05 was a disaster. Has, at that point, it's very, very much still stuck in fans and media's craw. The Bobby Bonilla signing, how the Mets have struggled with free agency, and how guys seem to come here. You were just, you know, a couple of years earlier, Mo Vaughn came here, and his bat turned to dust. Now, there were other reasons for those things happening, which we won't get into here. But then the following year, and really turned around, I think, early in the year when Julio Franco pushed him out of the dugout to take a curtain call, Beltran goes out. He's comfortable. He's realizing this is going to be home. He's surrounded by some solid veterans like Delgado, Laduca. You have Wright and Reyes emerging, and you know, Glavin in the rotation, a competitive team. And all of a sudden, he not only has a season where he finished top five in the MVP, won a gold glove, but the 2006 Beltran, the one that everybody remembers for striking out against an elite Adam Wainwright curveball, that was the best season of his career. And let me tell you, if he takes Wainwright to the gap and wins game seven, he gets canonized in this town. I mean, really think about it. That season, that Beltran year, and I think it's right up there with Wright's 07, so you could argue it, you know, data-driven-wise and what have you. You know, that could have been an immortalized season if not for that one at-bat. Gets forgotten about and sometimes looked at negatively, unfairly, of course, with one at-bat. So is Soto now heading into that? Good protection behind him with a different type of hitter. Comfortable. Let's see how he feels with this group of veterans, with a Simeon, with a Polanco. Maybe a different type of personality in that locker room. Him and Lindor felt each other out and now can, you know, just be themselves. And I think that's the key. The media is going to get all over, you know, playing junior psychologist. Let them be who they are. Everybody's different. That doesn't mean you care more or less. Everybody's different. And what do I understand about Soto? He's an intense worker. He cares a lot about his craft. I know some people will say, you know, might be it's a little bit selfish because he's looking at himself and his numbers. He hasn't ever really panned out in the outfield. But here's the part which really might make this his best season. He's now in left field, which he's had some success in the past. And I think it's a better position for his defensive limitations than certainly right field at Citi Field. We all knew back when he was at the Yankees and he was flopping around in right field during that Citi Field, during the Citi Field Subway Series portion. Even Keith Hernandez talked about it. And I had warned everybody when that was one of the first times that we here at the show was like, hey, let's recruit Soto. This is a big opportunity for Soto to see what he's missing here across town, right? You're moving him to left field. Brandon Nimmo, who at times was gimpy, hard worker, gimpy, survive left field. I think Soto can. And I think that that's going to comfort him a little bit. And then you have the stolen base factor. And I understand Anton Richardson's not here anymore. That doesn't mean the guy forgot the rules and the lessons. Maybe he's not going to steal 36 bases. I don't see why he couldn't do 40-40, as long as it's within the course of being responsible with the game, score, and situation. You could be having yourself a 40-40 guy here, with Soto really starting to move into that pantheon. And imagine if the next two or three years you have a guy who's going to hit. And in a lot of ways, we hear about Alonso's power. Soto dwarfed him. The thing about Soto is that he walks a lot, he hits home runs, but he doesn't do it in the prodigious way necessarily of Alonso. Alonso's a loud home run hitter. You always know his home runs. Soto quietly, I look up, like, he's got 43 home runs. It's amazing when you really think about it. You add that with 40 stolen base potential with a better situation on defense. And you know what? I know it's crazy for him. He's talking about winning the MVP. He's talking about Ohtani and all that stuff. Ohtani's on another level as a hitter. I mean, but similar to like LeBron, you can't give the MVP to the same guy every year because he's the best player in the sport. You have to look at it in the terms of the storyline and the narrative. This might be 2026 Soto's best year of his career. The next few years, I mean, we don't know where Bichette's going after this year, could be the best of the best. And you couple that, and I guess the concern you have is that's why the pitching and the situation and the kids coming up and how that matriculates in, you don't want to blow this opportunity. Now, in the midst of what's going on in L.A., them stacking the deck over there, timing probably can't be that much worse. But you can't think about that. I've always said sometimes good teams get stuck in the wrong era. There are good teams from the Western Conference in the 80s that were stuck behind the Dodgers, the Lakers. We talk about the Bulls run in the Eastern Conference in the 90s. Teams like the Knicks and Indiana, Orlando. Those are teams that we looked at differently if they just weren't in that same era against that player, that great player. Is that going to happen here in baseball? We'll see. You know, teams that were up against Tom Brady, things like that. So you know the whole score here. You know how it works out. But I think that the positive aspect is Simeon, Polanco, Bichette. I mean, you look at third base, you're going to get better average out of third base, maybe similar type of power. I think the big question is how you're going to make up probably the down slot of about 15 home runs from Alonso at first. I'm not sure Bichette is a power hitter. Maybe Robert Jr. makes up a little bit of it. Maybe you make up it more with simply just getting on base, simply higher average. I don't know if they're going to hit as many home runs. Now, playing into that is Alvarez. If Alvarez is healthy, plays every day, he could certainly pick up another 10 home runs out of that. And in a lot of ways, he might be the guy. And as a catcher, you have to always be careful with this because the days off and the wear down of the position. And who knows, maybe they throw him at DH a little bit. I know that that's dicey when you have two catchers because you could lose the DH if there's an injury. But that was where you could pick up some of that right-handed power. Because out of everybody on the roster, let's just talk right-handed power, Alvarez is the only one that could play in Alonso's league. He's just not as polished a hitter. And he hasn't been healthy like Alonso. So that's the thing. So, interesting stuff. Something to chew over. Is the Mets offense better? Can it be more consistent? Being better, I think, is also being part of consistency. And are we entering the best of Soto? Because when you think about Beltran's career, 06... 07, 08. I know that the negativity of the team overshadows it. That was the best you were going to get at Beltran. And he was on to a really, really good 09 before he had the injury to his knee, a serious injury that, and if we've talked about it, could have ended his career right there. Now, he had a second act, but you always lose 10 to 15 to 20% of that greatness when you come back from something that serious. The fact that he was able to play and play consistently, albeit not as a center fielder anymore, is tremendous. But he was headed to another elite. I mean, you probably were headed, if he didn't have that knee injury, 06 to 10, 11 would have been an elite five-year period for a center fielder. Got robbed a little bit of it, but you saw enough where, again, knock on a lot of wood with Soto staying healthy, the stolen base component, better position on defense. This could be the best version of Soto you're ever going to see. So something to think about. All right, let's take a quick break. We're going to wrap up Mailbag. We'll be back with more right after this. All right, we're back. Let's do the mailbag and wrap up here. I've been away from it the last couple of weeks, but back in the saddle, some good stuff. And ironically enough, and like I say, for those who are listening, you could email me, MikeSilvat@TalkingMetsPodcast.com. I put up threads on the chat room that I try to get feedback, so check out of that. Comments on an article, tweets, that gets a little bit messier. I try to like look at tweets. And just because I don't always mention you directly and I try to want to mention new names every week, that doesn't mean that I don't talk about the concept, because sometimes you guys give me concepts that I talk about. But let's start out with the Spotify comment over at Spotify from BP, who I guess wanted to talk a little bit about my conversation about the six-man rotation and why they're running it out. And he writes, the six-man rotation is because of the amount of games to start this season. It has nothing to do with Senga. They're trying to ease the pitchers in because many of them maxed out last year after their best ERA in baseball for half the season. Wouldn't that make sense to try to have your pitchers at full strength as the end of the year comes around? I think we'll see more of a Dodgers-like approach to slow playing guys back into action as injuries occur throughout the season. This is a fair comment, and yes, I do think that there is going to be, at least with Tong, Scott, and Weininger. And I know Weininger's only had a couple of outings that have been impressive here, and it's spring, but you hear a lot about him. You have to start putting him into the conversation, maybe not ahead of Tong, but right there with Scott, because Scott's injury and Scott coming back from an injury. I think they are going to slow play those guys. I think they do, and I've said McLean, even though he had, I think, about 160 innings last year, yes, he can go to 180, but if you anticipate a deep postseason run, you don't want to have a situation like you had with Matt Harvey 10 years ago where all of a sudden it's late in the year and you may not have enough innings, and I know that was the whole debate with Boris and Harvey for the postseason, and no, that's not why he got injured. I'm not going to get into that, but you do want to be able to at least have him fresh, so this is a very good point by BP. Goes back to what I said in the open. This is why Manaea and Senga are so important. If they're bad, and I'm talking second half bad, non-competitive bad, then you have a problem because you're sucking away quality potential starts from the top of the rotation. You're not getting 5 and 6 competitive starts. You're probably still burning out the bullpen, which is not good, especially because you only have one guy with options there, and that's Brazenbaum. And, I mean, then again, you may have to call on or be tempted to call on the kids early while Tong is developing and things like that. To me, that's worst case scenario. So I agree. Also remember, the Dodgers are in a position where they tend to know they're going to be making the postseason. They're not in the muck. I'm not so convinced the Mets won't be an in-the-muck team for a big chunk of the year. They need to prove a lot to me. They were one of the bottom five teams in the league in the second half. Now, I don't believe they're a bottom five team. But I don't believe they were the best in baseball in the beginning, so they're somewhere in the middle, which is an in-the-muck team. If you're an in-the-muck team, it's a lot harder to slow play it, especially when you're in that, hey, am I an 88-win team that could swing, which they've been, even during the year they went to the championship series. They've been an 83-88-win team that needs a streak to get to the high end. That's a very thin margin of error. In 2024, they played well in September. Last year, they didn't play well at all in the second half. So I agree, BP, but there are things that have to happen. The team has to play well. The team has to feel confident because maybe they do that at the beginning, but I think that that's going to be a little problematic at the end. Our buddy Jason has concerns. While spring training usually brings out a sense of optimism for the new year, I wanted to share a few concerns I've had over the last few days. Underwhelmed by Jonah Tong, while he dominates the minor leagues, his location and command during spring training and major league appearances has been spotty. When he throws in the zone, he gets hit, and he often his outs seem to require deep counts and high pitch volume. It appears he still has a lot of growing to do. Additionally, Sean Manaea sitting at 87 to 89, his fastball is highly concerning, especially the remaining contract in play. And he found it strange that Dylan Ross was cut early. So, I mean, Dylan Ross, I said it in the open, probably things that they saw that we didn't. Maybe there's a health issue. They're not going to tell us everything. I agree on Manaea. He's working on stuff. It looked like it just from his pitch mix that he's working on stuff. We'll see. We got 3 weeks left. As far as Tong, I've heard good things about Tong's ability to work and understand his craft. I also will say this. Let's use some recent history. What you described of Jonah Tong is exactly what I used to say about Zach Wheeler when he got called up. Zach Wheeler, until his Tommy John surgery, and really he was a late bloomer because he didn't really come around until second half 2018, and to a certain degree, he still had his troubles the following year, which is the inconsistency which led me not to feel good about giving him a long-term deal. The Phillies were right, I was wrong. But what you're describing about Tong is what they said about Wheeler. Now, not every pitcher comes up and dominates like McLean, like Skeens. Even Tarik Skubal had some growing pains until the last couple of years. Not everyone's like Doc. Just go on and on and on and on and on, right? But let's see. I think these are fair concerns, but let's see. So, that's something. So interesting comment there from our friend there. Another comment, an interesting comment, I guess something that might make you wonder from Steve. It's a couple of weeks old, but I wanted to get to this. Who was reviewing prospect lists and saw that the Mets could have drafted Kevin McConnell instead of Colin Houck, who has not really been an impressive pick. So one of the last drafts with Billy Epler and his team, he wonders if Chris Gross and Stearns were around, you know, might have been something that is very similar, unfortunately, to drafting Gavin Cecchini instead of Corey Sager. Well, you know, hard for me to say at that point. I agree with that. And, you know, draft is kind of a crapshoot. Look at Benj. The Mets got Benj. A lot of teams passed on him. So it'll be interesting to see. I think with Stearns here now and, you know, essentially Chris Gross and a really interesting front office team that so far has shown promise. There's still some more results that you need to see, but some promise. We'll see what this year brings. I feel much better about how they are drafting and developing players. Ben, I saw your tweet about Senga's outing and had a different perspective. While there's areas to improve, there was encouragement. Not only was his velo up, but the shapes of his pitches are better as well. The wind was blowing today on some of the hits he gave up. He also threw his forkball six times, one which was a home run. I did see that. But that was because his location was off. I agree with that. It was clear Senga was experimenting today as his pitch usage was quite different. Yep, same as I think with Manaea. I think Manaea was 100%, and that's fine. And all I said is it's a little bit of a red flag. That's it. That's all I said. And when you add in how fickle, and I said this in the open, pitching could be, and I know Robert Stock and Brandon Waddell were not expected to be the difference between the Mets winning a division or making the playoffs or not, but around the margins, depth, and we talked about this last week, depth is so important. That's how divisions are won. When you have a two-week period, think about when Lindor was out a week in 2024, how Acuña came up. And maybe it was a flash in the pan moment, but he came up and he was damn good for that week. You didn't miss Lindor that week on either side of the ball, which is hard to do when you have an MVP-type player. But what you saw last year is the Little League outings, the drop-off with the shuttling, and how you know, these guys struggled, you know, when there were certain players out. So thank you again. A good, interesting comment by Ben, and I agree. I mean, there's, you know, I think I might, I don't want anybody to misinterpret what I said during the show, the open. I'm not saying I'm worried about them. I'm just saying, just like some others, raise some eyebrows, especially Manaea's velocity. James Schwartz in the comments wrote, "I'm getting a little tired of left-handed bats being shielded for left-handed pitchers. If you continually take these lefties out when lefties are on the mound, they will never get to the point of being able to handle them. Beatty, in fact, hit lefties just fine last season, and I know he's not here anymore, but Nimmo did too. If Benj is the guy, then he needs to be hitting lefties when games are on the line. It has to do with the head as much as it goes along with the talent. The lefty-lefty thing needs to end." Well, James, not totally wrong. I think when you face a Chris Sale, I think that is something that you have to be a little concerned about. Obviously, you know, Tarek Skubal, you know, something like that. Those are guys that, you know, it would be nice to, not that it matters if it's lefty or righty, but it would be nice if you had some kind of compliment. It looks like Taylor will be that compliment. I think James was responding to my conversation about Taylor and Taylor's role, about how the Mets really don't have that righty outfield bat. Be nice if Talkman was a righty. But look, he's right. Talkman hits both sides pretty well. Maybe he's going to get an opportunity there. Taylor, if he can, you know, hone in on something here and bring some of that offense that you saw early in his career as a fourth outfielder in Milwaukee, spotting it on, you know we can play defense, spotting him in against some tough lefties, that'd be great. That's all I brought up. Probably right. If Benj is going to be Nick Markakis, if Benj is even going to be Steve Finley, he's going to have to hit both sides of the plate. I was thinking more you'd like to have that bat just in case. But, you know, with Robert Jr. in center, you have Simeon at second. Polanco's a switch hitter. Lindor's a switch hitter. Bichette's a righty. You do have enough of a balanced lineup now after your Polanco, Bichette, Robert acquisitions than you did before. So, you know, that's something there. So, interesting comment there by James. Going to the chat room, German Mets fan. Who's at first? Will they go with 5 or 6-man rotation? Is it 5? Who's out? Manaea, Senga, Peterson, Holmes. What to do with Vientos? But even with those questions, Mets camp seems almost too calm. Well, yes, you're right, German Mets fan, they are. And I know that this came up in other mailbags about, you know, is Vientos somebody that you could see the Mets trade? A couple of people, and I'm sorry if I don't mention you, but I know that I saw it twice sent to me. At this point, I see Vientos like J.D. Davis. He has to prove himself. Remember J.D. Davis came to camp in 2022? He's going to DH. I don't think he's going to get time at third. I know he made a nice play the other day for Nicaragua. Anybody could do that. And look, he's got a good arm, and at times in 24, he was adequate at third. But I just don't see it. You know, I just don't see it. If Bichette's a disaster and has to DH, maybe. First base, if I'm him, I try to be competent at first base. That's where you would see maybe him sub in a little bit. I talked about it earlier in case you don't have that middle infielder as a backup. You might need Polanco to shift there to the middle infield at some point. So then you're going to have an opening at first. That's for Beatty or Vientos, or at least to give the guy a blow on certain days. So I wouldn't say they trade Vientos. Now, if Vientos is doing halfway decent and he's a round peg in a square hole and they have a need later in the year and they don't see that he's going to be Eugenio Suarez and they're throwing away a 30-home run bat that's still cost-controlled, you know, unless he's Vientos of 2024, which was an impact bat in the middle of the order, I could see him being part of a deal like how they sent J.D. Davis out, hopefully better than for Darren Ruff, but water under the bridge, right? So will they go with a 5 or 6-man rotation, German Mets fan? It's six. Where it goes, you know, we brought up those questions. And look, I think there you're right. Mets camp does seem to be very calm, and that's a good thing. And when you have a team that's well-run, when you have a team that's put together competently, when you have a front office that has good people in there, and you have a manager that takes care and he has a clean clubhouse, and professional veterans, may I add, to boot, that's the way things should be. Not great for radio, because now you're just talking baseball. So, but we like talking baseball here. All right, that's it. We got some mailbag in. There'll be more. I'll get some more next week. Just wanted to end off on a high note here with some of the mailbag, some of the commentary, some of the things that are on your mind. Of course, keep it coming. I'm sure there'll be some things born from this show. We have some loyal listeners that like to get in every week. Others, you know, obviously time to time. If you haven't, send me an email. Use a pseudonym. I won't use a real name, but I want to hear from you. I think it makes a good way to wrap up the show every week for about 10 minutes or so, wrap up with some of the best conversation, some of the best commentary out there. And I know I took a couple of weeks off, and even 1 week, I got some feedback. Not everybody loved me having somebody read emails on the air and giving their perspective. It was something different. You wanted to hear my opinion. I'm humbled by that. It was something we try once in a while, bring a guest on to help out. So we'll see. So anyway, I want to thank everybody for tuning in to this latest edition of the Talking Mets podcast. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com, and come join us at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. Chat for free, updates on the show, premium content. You want to know what's going on in the Talking Mets world? Go to TalkingMetsPodcast.com. And I want to thank the good folks from the Believe Network for supporting this show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. Till then, take care, everybody.